Welcome to S&C's podcast series, S&C's Critical Insights. My name is Julia Malkina. I'm a partner in the litigation group. I'm here today with my litigation partner, Jeff Scott. Today, we will discuss recent trends and emerging issues in private securities litigation.
Julia, let's start by looking at some recent numerical trends in private securities litigation. Now, notwithstanding the existence of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, which was designed to eliminate frivolous securities litigation, we saw a record number of securities class actions filed in 2019. The plaintiffs bar filed 428 securities class actions in 2019, which is the most on record, up slightly from 420 in 2018 and 413 in 2017. And this greatly exceeded the 20-year average of 215 from 1997 to 2018. So we have seen in the last few years a very significant increase in the filing of securities class actions. Now, putting aside M&A-related litigation, new federal filings against technology companies have more than doubled since 2017, from 14 to 29, while federal filings against companies in the financial sector remain below the 20-year historical average. In 2019, non-M&A federal filings against communications companies reached their highest number since 2002 at 37.
One of the reasons for the increase in securities class actions is undoubtedly the Supreme Court's 2018 decision in Cyan v. Beaver County Employees Retirement Fund. In Cyan, the Supreme Court held that plaintiffs may bring claims under the Securities Act of 1933 in state court, and that defendants may not remove those claims to federal court. The 33 Act encompasses claims that a registration statement or prospectus contain material misstatements or omissions. Since Cyan, there has been a significant growth in the filing of 33 Act claims in state court. In 2019, there were in fact more 33 Act claims filed in state court than in federal court, contributing to the growth in security class actions generally. There were 18 33 Act class action filings in New York, leading the pack. There were 15 such filings in California, and 16 in other states. This is up from only 6 in other states in 2018. We're also seeing a significant amount of duplicative litigation. In approximately 45% of 2019 state court 33 Act cases, there was a parallel federal court case.
Julie, with the spike in state 33 Act cases post-Cyan, I think you'd agree with me that there are several important issues regarding how those suits will be conducted in state courts. For example, in 33 Act cases in federal court, it is well settled that the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, or the PSLRA, stays all discovery pending a motion to dismiss barring exceptional circumstances. In the post-Cyan cases being filed in state court, an important question is currently being litigated across the country in state courts is whether the PSLRA discovery stay is applicable to these state court actions.
I agree, Jeff. In New York, judges in the state trial courts have split on the issue, and there is no appellate guidance as of yet. One New York state judge has held in two cases that the stay does not apply, briefly noting without further explanation that to hold that the PSLRA automatic stay applies to state court actions would undermine Cyan's holding that 33 Act cases can proceed in state courts. At least one California court also has held that the stay does not apply, stating that the PSLRA's provision for a discovery stay is of a procedural nature and therefore only applies to actions filed in federal court.
By contrast, Julia, another New York state judge has held that the stay applies under the plain text of the statute. The court noted that the simple, plain, and unambiguous language expressly provides that discovery is stayed during a pending motion to dismiss in any private action arising under this subchapter, of which Section 11 is one, and contrasted this with other PSLRA provisions, which specifically refer to actions brought pursuant to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedures. A Connecticut court also has held that the stay applies under an essentially identical statutory analysis, And we also have a pre-Cyan California ruling, which relied on a similar textual analysis to find that the stay applies. Another New York State Court judge expressed some skepticism that a stay is required by the language of the PSLRA, but the judge nonetheless stayed discovery because of the policy concerns behind the PSLRA stay, which is primarily ensuring that cases have merit at the outset. I expect that the applicability of the PSLRA discovery stay to state court actions bringing 33 Act claims will continue to be vigorously litigated in state courts.
As we have discussed, Jeff, the increase in parallel filings in state court also raises the issue of when state proceedings should be stayed in favor of the federal cases. New York courts have looked to the general stay factors in determining whether to stay 33 Act state cases in favor of federal proceedings. Those factors are whether the federal action was commenced first and the stage of litigation, whether there is substantial overlap between the parties, issues, and relief requested, where a more complete disposition of issues may be obtained, whether a stay will avoid duplication of effort, waste of judicial resources, and the risk of inconsistent rulings, whether plaintiffs have demonstrated how they would be prejudiced by a stay, and which court possesses a greater familiarity with the trial of such issues.
Julia, among the factors you just listed, it appears to me the factor that seems to be doing the most work is which action is first filed. Indeed, several New York courts have state actions filed after a similar federal proceeding.
I agree with that, Jeff. The New York courts are significantly less likely to stay a state court action when the federal action was later filed. Unlike the 33 Act, the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, which governs the sale of securities on the secondary market, gives exclusive jurisdiction to the federal courts. Allowing for the disposition of both 33 Act and 34 Act claims in one forum appears to motivate some of these decisions to stay state cases in favor of a federal action as well.
Well, let's turn to the pleading standards that may apply in state court. In federal court, Section 11 claims are subject to, at a minimum, the Twombly-Iqbal plausibility pleading standard. They also may be subject to the heightened Rule 9b pleading standard, which requires plaintiffs to state with particularity the circumstances constituting fraud if the allegations in the complaint sound in fraud. However, there is more variability in state court pleading standards, many of which are more lenient. For example, California has a particularly lenient requirement, which requires only a statement of the facts constituting the cause of action in ordinary and concise language. Given the large volume of Section 11 cases in California, this likely is one reason why motions to dismiss Section 11 claims in state court cases have been granted at a lower rate at 28% versus the grant rate of 39% in federal court cases over the period of 2011 to 2019.
Like federal courts, some state courts also have heightened pleading standards for claims that sound in misrepresentation or fraud, even if the cause of action does not have fraud as a component. Recently, one New York state court applied New York's heightened pleading standard for misrepresentations to a Section 11 claim under the 33 Act. However, another New York state judge decided only a few weeks later that New York's heightened pleading standard for misrepresentations does not apply, reasoning that the standard for liability in 33 Act cases is negligence, and New York's heightened pleading standard generally does not apply to negligence cases. With the additional burdens, risks, and uncertainties of state court 33 Act claims, some companies have added federal forum provisions to their charters or bylaws. Such provisions provide that all 33 Act claims against the company must be brought in federal court. The Delaware Supreme Court recently held that such provisions are valid as a matter of Delaware corporate law. This is an important decision that may curb the rise of state 33 Act claims, but it remains to be seen whether other state courts will enforce federal forum provisions. This is important because state 33 Act claims are mostly brought outside of Delaware, and the efficacy of federal forum provisions will depend on whether the state courts in which the 33 Act claims are brought enforce them.
Julia, let's address another important issue that continues to be litigated in securities class actions, And that concerns what standard applies to a defendant's burden to rebut the basic presumption left open by the Supreme Court's well-known decision in Halliburton II. Now, by invoking the basic presumption, securities plaintiffs need not show direct reliance on alleged misstatements as long as the statements were public and material, the stock was traded in an efficient market, and the plaintiff traded in the stock during the relevant period. The presumption is based on what is called the fraud on the market theory, and that is that the market price of a security traded in an efficient market incorporates all public material information. It is the basic presumption that allows most securities fraud lawsuits to proceed as class actions.
In Halliburton II, the Supreme Court declined to overrule basic, but the court held that a defendant may rebut the basic presumption at the class certification stage by showing a lack of price impact from the alleged misrepresentation. However, the Supreme Court did not set out what standard the defendant has to satisfy for rebutting the presumption. Federal Rule of Evidence 301 provides the general standard for presumptions in civil cases. That is, the party against whom a presumption is directed has the burden of producing evidence to rebut the presumption, but this rule does not shift the burden of persuasion.
Julie, as you're aware, a circuit split has developed between the Eighth Circuit, which has held that defendants have only the burden to come forward with evidence showing a lack of price impact under Federal Rule of Evidence 301. And the Second Circuit, which has stated that defendants must rebut the basic presumption by disproving reliance by a preponderance of the evidence at the class certification stage. And that's in a case called Wagner v. Barclays PLC. Now, there are very strong arguments that Federal Rule of Evidence 301 should govern a defendant's rebuttal right under Halliburton II instead of preponderance of the evidence standard. Ultimately, I believe that this debate will likely need to be resolved by the Supreme Court.
Shifting gears away from class certification, we should highlight that we are beginning to see COVID-19-related securities litigation. These cases involve responses to COVID-19, such as statements about vaccines or testing, alleged attempts to downplay the impact of COVID-19 on continuing operations, such as for cruise operators and rental properties, and issues allegedly exposed due to the heightened use of certain products following the outbreak of COVID-19, such as supposed securities flaws in Zoom's video chat products. We've seen multiple cases against Cruise Line pending in the Southern District of Florida, based on alleged misstatements regarding their positive outlook and COVID-19 preventative measures. There's a case out in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania alleging that a pharmaceutical company made misleading statements regarding its development of a COVID-19 vaccine. Multiple complaints have also been filed against Zoom in the Northern District of California, alleging a failure to disclose data privacy issues, which caused a stock price decline when revealed following the COVID-19 outbreak. And there's a case in the Southern District of New York regarding a January 2020 ADS offering by a real estate management company with holdings in China, including Wuhan, alleging that the company failed to disclose the extent to which it was already suffering from the impact of COVID-19 on the rental market in China. Similarly, in the Southern District of New York, we have a case alleging that a defendant's disclosures about distributing an anticipated large order of COVID-19 diagnostic tests were overstated or entirely fabricated.
Julia, the COVID-related cases that you just referred to are largely related to the initial impact of the crisis. It really remains to be seen what types of securities litigation may arise from the continuing effects of the crisis and the associated shutdown orders, but several categories of suits come to mind when you think about this issue. First, there may be cases involving companies with day-to-day operations directly impacted by travel restrictions and social distancing, such as cruise operators and airlines, where there could be potentially inadequate risk disclosures or misstatements regarding the estimated impact of the pandemic to their core business. There also may be cases concerning companies involved in the immediate response to the pandemic based on potentially misleading statements about their response. And companies that come to mind are pharmaceutical companies or manufacturers, for example, of protective equipment. There also may be cases where underlying weaknesses in finances, supply chains, products, etc., are revealed by the crisis, leading to allegations of prior insufficient risk disclosures. Now, in light of the risk of such claims being brought, companies really should be very careful in reviewing their disclosures with the assistance of both internal and external counsel to make sure they are adequately disclosing any material impact that the ongoing COVID pandemic is having on the company's financial performance, business operations, and activities that concern material business lines or units of those companies.
The SEC has issued multiple pieces of guidance on COVID-19 disclosures, which could be helpful to companies to the extent they can argue in COVID-19-related securities litigation that their disclosures followed the SEC guidance. Conversely, plaintiffs may supplement securities litigations with allegations that companies violated the SEC's guidance, such as the guidance of April 8th, which suggests that companies disclose, quote, where the company stands today, operationally and financially, how the company's COVID-19 response, including its efforts to protect the health and well-being of its workforce and its customers, is progressing, and how its operations and financial condition may change as all of our efforts to fight COVID-19 progress.
That's all we have for today concerning emerging issues in private securities litigation. Thank you for listening to S&C Critical Insights. For more information about our practice, please visit us on the web at www.solcrom.com. Please also join Julia and me for our S&C Critical Insights on the priorities of the SEC's Enforcement Division and recent securities enforcement trends.